All right, my last job is to do a brief introduction. The moderator for tonight is Wendy Walker. That's all that needs to be said. Wendy has been the executive director of Leadership Florida for 26 years. She has built that organization into a national model. She has become, over that time, I think, a Florida icon. There is not a nook or cranny in this state whereas she is not known and deeply respected. We are very lucky to have her moderate tonight's discussion, and so I give you Wendy Walker.
Thank you, Steve. All right, so hello to all of you out there tonight. I'm really glad to see so many people here for a civil conversation, especially the first person I met when I moved to Tallahassee 46 years ago is my advisor from FSU, Dr. Charles Nam. So happy to see you here. Still. I think you know that the theme for this year's Village Square Dinners is Curiouser and Curiouser, Through the Looking Glass of Modern Politics. And of course, Alice's Wonderland was a place ruled by nonsense and incoherence, and where Alice said it would be so nice if something made sense for a change. And I think that a lot of us are feeling that way right now. So we bring you tonight's dinner, which is Tumbling Down the Rabbit Hole, a Citizen's Election Survival Guide. And who better to make sense of it all than two experienced political insiders who have long approached politics from the opposite sides of the wall, but who are sitting side by side tonight, committed together to helping guide us through the baffling world of American politics in 2016. First, nearly 30 years ago, Steve VanCor laid the wires, bought a box of 24 single-line phones, and plugged them into a makeshift phone bank in an abandoned conference room. He hired a bunch of students from FSU and used his newly minted degree, oversaw what would be the first of several thousand polls that he's conducted, almost all of them right here in Tallahassee. Tonight, Steve is still engaged in campaigns across our state and is going to share some of his insights from the ground level of politics in this wacky state during the craziest of political seasons. Some of you know Steve as the guest host of The Usual Suspects, as an adjunct professor at FSU, or as someone who has been deeply engaged in local and state politics since before Dempsey Barron was Senate president. And about Senator Barron, perhaps no coincidence that the first poll Steve ever conducted was to see if the man who ran the Florida Senate with an iron fist, who told a sitting governor to get the hell out of my Senate, was vulnerable. He was, and we have with us the 27-year-old who predicted and helped bring about his political demise, Steve VanCor. Sally Bradshaw has been a very significant figure in the political arena for 30 years. Most recently, she was senior advisor to former Governor Jeb Bush's presidential campaign and has also served as his gubernatorial campaign manager and was his chief of staff when he was governor. In 2008, Sally was senior advisor to presidential candidate Governor Mitt Romney. She is a former political director of the Republican Party of Florida, and she worked in both the 1992 and 1988 presidential campaigns of George H.W. Bush. Following the president's election, she worked in the White House as an associate director of political affairs. Sally also has fairly recently had a front seat as the Republican Party assessed the results of the 2012 election cycle, when she was co-chair of the RNC's Growth and Opportunity Project, which issued recommendations for the future growth of the Republican Party. I am very pleased to welcome to our panel the self-described crazy lady who is opening an independent bookstore in the age of Amazon, Sally Bradshaw. So they will get wired up. And I just want to say that my job tonight will be to just stay out of their way. They are smart, they are engaging, and they are incredibly knowledgeable about what's going on in the political world we live in right now. So I'm going to ask them a few questions from time to time, and I'm going to go out in the audience with the hope that you, too, will ask them some questions. Yeah. So would either of you like to open with some comments, or do you want us to dive right in?
You want to start, or you want me to start?
You can go ahead and start.
Go ahead, Steve.
This is the, can you all hear me? This is the second time I've had the honor of sitting on a panel with Sally. I'm reminded of an interview after a basketball game I saw where this gentleman came off and he had scored a point in a basketball game. And when we got off that panel down in the Breakers, somebody said, "You guys did a great job." So this, in this post-game interview, this guy scored 1 point. Michael Jordan scored 59. And he said, "I like to think of tonight as the night that Michael and I teamed up to score 60 points." It's really, it is an honor to be with you again. This is a lot of fun. Sally's going to give you an amazing perspective of stuff you saw on CNN and Fox News and MSNBC of the presidential. My career path has taken me on a very different course, and I deal in a lot of local elections. And I wanted to give you some through-the-looking-glass moments that I personally experienced in this most recent election that, for somebody who's been doing this since 1986, I've seen my share of craziness in elections, especially in local elections. Minor point of correction, I've done several thousand polls in the state of Florida. Y'all would really hate me if I did several thousand polls right here in Tallahassee, because every one of you would have been called about 30 times this week alone. So let me tell you three things. One, I want to use an insect analogy. It's not that old joke about politics. Poly means many, ticks are blood-sucking parasites. But think of, I remember seeing this National Geographic special about these insects that were so in sync with a flower that when the flower was ready to pollinate, only that one insect was able to pollinate it, and that insect would come in and derive food and continue its life cycle, and the flower would open in perfect timing and perfect sync, developed over thousands and thousands of years of evolution in synchronization with that insect. And when the synchronization fell out, bad things happened to both. As I look at this election cycle, and what just happened in 16 in the Democratic and Republican primaries, consider this. Just 20 years ago, about 95% of voters cast votes on this thing called Election Day. We don't have Election Day anymore. In 4 years ago, two-thirds of voters voted on Election Day. Pretty dramatic shift. This year, just under two-thirds of voters voted before Election Day. What does that mean? Let me explain to you something. that all these associations that many of you have worked for or worked with, whether it's the realtors, the chamber, whomever, their life cycle, their part of their ecosystem, doesn't really start happening till the summertime. And candidates, however, realize that 30, 40, 50% of the electorate, when you think of election day, what pops into your mind? November. And then I say, well, you got the primaries, which is also changing, right? The primaries are also changing, and that they're becoming so much more important. But how many of you realize that for the majority of voters, Election Day begins in early August? So what does that mean? Think of the bee and the flower. The bee, the insect, of course, being the politicians, have to start communicating with the electorate in June and July. So guess what? The electorate is not ready to start giving up their pollen just yet. And so they're very reluctant to listen to political messaging. So candidates up it. They go more and more and more and more. And this complete out of synchronization is creating on the ground some real odd outcomes. And let me give you one example. I was involved in a race down in Broward County, one of my favorite places to campaign. And Representative Jacobs is here as living proof of that. And this one campaign started its campaign, its direct mail and its television and its door-to-door campaign in June. High resistance of voters. Voters weren't moving on the direct mail. The mail would land, and no change in the polls. So what did they do? They did more mail and more mail and more mail. Okay? By the way, for those of you, let me just see by a quick show of hands, how many of you like to receive negative mail attacking the other opponent? How many? That's what I thought. But you know what's interesting about it, and it's kind of a, it causes me anxiety personally. If I drop 8 pieces of mail, let's just say about Lori Dozier, you're not likely to believe or recall that. But if I say one bad thing about Lori, and everybody knows Lori, you know it wouldn't be true, you're more likely to move in my polling. So you, the voter, tell me, send me more negative mail. Because that's what I believe, that's what I recall, that's what's going to change the polls. So I don't really, you know, you can blame the campaigns, you can blame the consultants, but the voters are the ones who react to the political mail. So in this one particular campaign, we started escalating, the other side started escalating with more and more mail. How many remember Charlie Williams, Senator Charlie Williams, and Richard Mitchell? I recruited Richard Mitchell to run, he ran, and we beat that sitting senator with 12 pieces of mail. That was considered shocking. You could just do 12 pieces of mail, oh my gosh. About 10 years later, I did a mayor's race down in West Palm. We sent 17 pieces of mail to the average voter, and some voters got as many as 3 or 4 other pieces, about 20 pieces of mail. In this particular race this year, given the voter resistance, the out of synchronization, my candidate sent 41 pieces of mail. The opposition sent over 25 pieces of mail. Woe be to that likely voting Democrat in South Florida. The average typical voter received from this one campaign only 70 pieces of mail. I heard a gasp. Well, Steve, are they allowed to gasp at that? But that's gasp-worthy, is it not? $1 million on TV for one state Senate race. This was not the exception in a competitive primary election. This has now become the rule. Let me give you one other, I think, gasp-worthy moment. When I began polling on that Dempsey-Barron race, in order to get 300 completions on a poll, I needed 3,000 phone numbers, about a 1-to-10 ratio. I'd put them in, we'd get 300 completions, we'd get a reliable, valid poll. Okay, about dial 10 numbers, you get one completion. Beginning the cycle, that number had climbed because of cell phones and voter resistance, et cetera, to between 20 and 30 to 1, depending on the district. Because, again, going back to my out of sync and more communications, more and more phone banking, more and more communications of all sorts and negative communications, voters started to become more and more resistant. Now, hold this for a thought. Hold that thought for a second. We start the election, 35,000 likely voters. Okay, 35,000. That means about 28,000 households. 28,000 households means about 24,000 phone numbers. Hold on to that number, 24,000. Here I am trying to do a poll. I need to get 400 completions. Because of the resistance of the voters, that number climbed to 60 to 1. 6 times 4 is 24. That means every night we were calling every single voter to try to get a poll out of them. We threw up our hands. We told the client, stop polling. This is ridiculous. But the fact that to poll a random sample We had to call every single household we had a phone number for. Speaks to the lunacy of one election. We were involved in probably a dozen primaries around the state. And as a poll, I'm a professional pollster. My company's a poll, it does polling as well. So we were doing, we shut them down. We told all of our clients, guys, we'd love your money, but this is complete and utter nonsense, much like we see in Alice in Wonderland. So where does this go? I have no idea. With the amount of money, the amount of importance we're placing on some of these state House races and state Senate races, and the fact that voters, it's like an arms race. They don't want to hear from us, but we got to talk to them. We got to find new and innovative ways to beat their doors down, literally beating their doors down, literally knocking on their doors, literally hitting their phones, hitting their social media, digital pre-roll. If you're on the internet and you want to watch any video, Tom Brady throwing a touchdown pass or Charlie biting his finger, not Charlie Ransom, but that little Charlie biting his finger, you've got to watch one of my ads beforehand. Yet, we know that 50% of voters will not see a TV spot, a political TV spot this year. So that's the arms race, and that's just some things that the different ground level that you're at that we witnessed this year that I, before I even saw this program, I was like, it is bizarre and crazy, and I don't know where it's going. Your turn.
I got nothing. No, I'm getting ready to tell everybody why all the money in the world you spend doesn't matter anymore, because I learned the valuable lesson that $100 million does not get you what you need to do in a presidential primary. I'm from Mississippi, so I have to visit with everybody for a minute before we get to the meat of things. Okay. So I'm thrilled to be with you again. It is always fun to be with Steve VanCore. I don't think people realize what a resource Steve is for our community. He's an excellent data junkie. He's an excellent statistician and pollster. He's probably the smartest pollster that no one knows, because although you do have a small TV show, you are not out promoting yourself nationally. You put your head down, you do the job. We had great fun a couple of years ago exploring the, can you hear me? I'm getting the signal from Liz. Exploring no major party voters, and at the time I never thought I would be an NMP. So that's just one example of what this cycle has done to each of us. But I'm grateful to be with you again. It's a lot of fun. Steve Seibert. Steve Seibert was our designated moderate at a time when Jeb Bush was actually conservative. Somehow he morphed into a moderate in the presidential race, but Steve was our designated moderate in Jeb world. Steve and I worked together when I was Governor Bush's chief of staff, and he was the secretary of the Department of Community Affairs. May it rest in peace. But you did an excellent job at DCA, and the Village Square is really lucky to have you. Wendy, thank you for being able to facilitate this. Everybody knows Wendy from Leadership Florida, and what a remarkable job you've done there. So thank you for this. And Liz Joyner, always running around the room. Liz and I, our friendship is a direct result of the Village Square. We have a friend, Lee Marshall. I don't know, is Lee here? I heard Lee was coming tonight. And Lee is a teacher, a theater teacher at Leon, and believed in what the Village Square preaches. She said, I have these two crazy friends. Both of them are political opposites, but I know they love bagels. And so if I can just get them together for a bagel and a cup of coffee, all of the world's problems will be solved. So I don't know how many years ago we got together to do that, but I've been blessed to do several programs with the Village Square, and it's really fun to be back. This is a year when we need the Village Square, so thank you for that. It is a wild and crazy year. We used to joke in the campaign. We had no explanation for it. We just said, buckle your seatbelt and read the safety card and the seat back in front of you, because that is about all you can do this particular cycle. The last 2 years of my life, I spent traveling for Jeb Bush all over the country, from San Francisco to Des Moines, Iowa, Columbia, South Carolina, to Las Vegas, Nevada, and a lot of trips to Miami. And it was really a remarkable opportunity for me. No one thought Jeb Bush was going to run for president at first. In fact, those of us who worked with him, Brandy Brown is here, Kim Bertrand, we weren't quite sure either. He did something unusual in this day and age, which is he actually thought about whether he could run for president and whether he would be a good president. And so he spent a year very quietly meeting with people all over the country, policy experts in the military and foreign policy and the economy and technology and the environment, to see how they thought we could solve our nation's problems before he made a decision to jump. And so several of us were involved in that fact-finding period When he called us and said, we're going to go, we were quite surprised, but he immediately moved to do things that you would expect our former governor to do. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, if you live through Jeb Bush's 8 years of being governor here, you knew he always prepared. Tina Pate is shaking her head. She knows this. You always had to be on your toes. And so he immediately re-released 280,000 emails. In preparation for the campaign and wrote a book about it. He released extensive medical records, 30 years of tax returns, and then he held what many reporters called the best announcement of any candidate in the field, Republican or Democrat. I don't know why he would have thought tax returns would have been relevant, emails might be relevant. Go figure. And then he made this announcement in Miami, and it was widely hailed as an announcement where a Republican actually reached out to other people and campaigned, as he said, with his arms open and not closed. The very next day, Donald Trump rode down the escalator of Trump Towers in New York and announced that he was running for president. And the race was never the same from that moment on. So I want to talk a little bit about what we saw in our bird's eye view from the trail and how some of these challenges feed into some of the issues that Steve has raised. I hope we eventually get around to how we can survive the election cycle. I'm not sure where we end up on that. But I want to talk about it briefly. In mid-February, I kissed my husband goodbye, kissed my youngest daughter goodbye, picked up a copy of the Wall Street Journal, and headed to the Tallahassee Airport for what I thought would be an extended tour through the Super Tuesday states. Jeb had lost the Iowa caucus, which we expected. He came in fifth place. Some people argued he shouldn't even play in the Iowa caucus. But he wanted to reach every voter, and so we stayed in through the bitter end in Iowa, and we headed to New Hampshire, where we did much better. By this point in time, everyone knew Trump was there to stay. And because the field consisted of 17 candidates on the Republican side, it was mathematically possible for a populist candidate like Donald Trump to get 35% of the vote in every state, and the remaining 16 candidates fought over the leftover scraps. And so we were fighting it out with Ted Cruz in New Hampshire, came in a very close third, and headed into what should have been our place, our area, our place to win, South Carolina and the southern states. And we had hoped to do well and go on to South Carolina. That was not the case. If you ever wonder whether endorsements matter, we had received the endorsement of U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham, who is just one of the most fun people I've ever campaigned with in my life. In fact, he came into our debate preps and he told Jeb, Jeb, you have to practice your one-liners. And Jeb is so studious and he knew all the policy in great detail. But Lindsey Graham's specialties were one-liners. And so Jeb said, well, Lindsey, what should I say? And he said, here's what I want you to say at the next debate. I want you to stand up when Trump talks about that stupid wall and say, you know what, Donald? If you get elected president, Canada is going to build a wall and Canada is going to pay for it. It was a beautiful line. And Jeb just sort of said, okay, let's keep going here. We got to keep practicing. But Lindsey Graham was great fun to have on the trail. So that was a big endorsement for us. And we roared into South Carolina. Our numbers were moving. It appeared Jeb was taking off. And at some point in time, the governor of South Carolina decided that she, Nikki Haley, was going to endorse Marco Rubio, one of our opponents. And when she did that, she is such a popular governor, we just hit a wall and everything changed. Now, we had the resources to stay in. We could have continued the race at that point. But Jeb Bush, as he is wont to do, decided Donald Trump cannot be our nominee. And what I've got to do is step aside and let somebody else have a go at him, because with 16 people in the field, this is just not going to work. 15, 14 people, we can't tackle him. So he withdrew from the race, you know, before it even began. And that was the case for multiple candidates. Chris Christie pulled out of the race after New Hampshire when he lost New Hampshire. Scott Walker had pulled out of the race. Rick Perry had pulled out of the race. What was it about this year that caused all of these guys who were arguably qualified to serve as president not to be able to make it? Well, I want to talk about that briefly, and I have brought some cheat sheet slides so Steve and I can play with these a little bit. You know, before 2016, Steve and I and other operatives practiced certain tactics and strategies for winning campaigns. I would like to tell you they're more complicated than this, because I know Steve gets paid a lot of money to do this, but these are the basics of what we've always thought you had to do to win a race. You have to raise and spend the most money. You have to produce substantive policy proposals, prepare for debates, buy television, build a highly targeted schedule, and use voter contact. And this is an area that Steve can talk about in more detail, increasingly built on very targeted voter models. So literally, if you subscribe to Golf Digest or Good Housekeeping, we know that as political operatives, and we can decide what that might mean in terms of the way you vote and what we should actually do with that. There are two candidates in particular on both sides of the aisle that followed the script pretty well, and I think you know them. Both Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton thought this would be a traditional campaign. And to some extent for Clinton, it was much more traditional simply because her field was smaller. That did not mean that Bernie Sanders did not significantly impact and prolong the Democrat primary. But these two candidates followed this script. Okay, how do you actually win in 2016? This is not an exaggeration. We found this to be the case in both sides of the aisle. Phone in to cable TV. I can remember being in our Miami headquarters when we were trying to get Governor Bush on Fox News, and we were running into some real challenges. We offered to fly him to New York to put him in the studio. We're literally watching this big TV screen, and the Fox, whoever is hosting Fox News that morning, is talking to Donald Trump on the phone. He's the first candidate who was able to phone into cable TV, and the networks would cover it because of the
campaigning in your underwear.
He did. We're convinced he was in his pajamas phoning into these TV programs. I don't have to say much about his tweets. We're going to take a look at that in a minute. Big rallies, largely devoid of substantive policy, and there were two candidates who very effectively deployed these tactics, and that's why I joked a little about Steve and mail and phones and all of the traditional ways of contacting voters that have always worked. Things changed in the cycle. So is this a trend, or is this a real sea change, or is this an anomaly going forward? And I want to talk about why I think we're in the midst of a real sea change, why there are three or four trends that are affecting political campaigns, at least at the national level, and how that might apply at the state and local level as well. Starting with the middle class maelstrom, new media, social and digital had a huge impact on the cycle. The Big Sort, which was a trend recognized by Liz Joyner and those of you who were involved with the Village Square several years ago. We had a fabulous program on the Big Sort, and I'll talk about that in more detail. And the changing demographics, which are completely overwhelming the nature of presidential politics. So the middle class maelstrom or meltdown. When I was on the way to South Carolina, I picked up a copy of the Wall Street Journal. I mentioned this and read an article by Charles Murray. Anybody know Charles Murray? He is a scholar with the American Enterprise Institute. It took my breath away. We saw in our data that people were angry. We knew that was the case. But this is a chart from his piece that shows five decades of decline among the middle class. These are white men with a working class job and no more than a high school diploma in the labor force. 95% in 1970, down to 79% in 2015. Those are remarkable numbers. These are not Republicans or Democrats. This is a mix of all voters in the labor force. Look at the marriage rate. That is fascinating to me, and how much you've seen the breakdown of the nuclear family at the same time. Middle-income households in America, 1971 to 2015, an 11% drop in middle-income households over that period of time. But look at this. Look at the income gains at the top of the chart. These are the one percenters that you read so much about. 192% income growth for the top 1% of income earners since 1980. Look at the middle 60%. And then the bottom 20%. It's interesting to me that the bottom 20% have seen higher gains than the middle class. There is a safety net in place that has protected those folks. And you can begin to understand how middle class voters are sick and tired of Washington, D.C. not being able to do anything for them. No pay raise in 15 years for the middle class. So combine that with a huge shift in the way we receive media and news and information. This chart may be a little hard to see. The two things I want you to try to look at are 65-plus voters and 18 to 29 voters. Total flip depending upon your age. If you are 65-plus, you still get 60% of your news from cable TV and the network nightly news. But if you're 18 to 29, 50% of your media comes from an app, a website, or social media. There were plenty of times in the campaign when our children would know something before I would, with all the resources of a presidential campaign, simply because they follow Instagram. It's remarkable if you look at this, and you can't underestimate the significance of the access to social and digital media as a force in this cycle, and particularly going forward. Okay, I don't even have to tell you what this is. Who do you think is red? The top search GOP candidate by county in the United States, Donald Trump, overwhelmingly. And this is earned media versus free media. So I think most of you understand this, but bought media, paid media, is when Steve buys a television spot that runs before the nightly news. Earned media is when Donald Trump sits in his pajamas and phones into Fox News. He doesn't have to pay for that. It is invaluable. Deep Root Analytics, which is a Republican data firm in D.C., went through to calculate the amount of free media the candidates received this cycle. Donald Trump, $2 billion, $2 billion worth of earned media. Clinton, $746 million, Sanders, $321, and Jeb did pretty well at $214, bringing up the rear. It's pretty remarkable what earned media has done in this cycle. So I talked about the big sort. Several years ago, Liz and her team had a journalist in from Austin, Bill Bishop. Bishop worked with a professor at the University of Texas to prepare some groundbreaking research. He was convinced that people were starting to move to neighborhoods that looked like them. It used to be that the vote was more spread out, and you can see in 1976, you had significantly competitive markets. The white shows areas where there was competition for the presidential race between Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford. The other two colors show, if I move to the big sort back, you would see that the state of Georgia was dominated by Jimmy Carter. It was not very competitive. But you do see a lot of the country, both in the heartland and in California and up east, as competitive. That was 1976. In 2004, look at that. Look how few competitive counties and areas of the country are left after the big sort. Where you live determines how you vote. More and more people are moving towards people who look and sound and think like them. That is incredibly destructive for decision making, for problem solving.
We talked the other night about a statistic that people are more likely to marry somebody of another race than they are of another party.
Yeah. How about that? So Bishop, this is a fascinating book, and I'd highly recommend it to you. I think there have been some updates since he issued the book. But the big sort was a real problem for politics this cycle. And I love this slide because the guy says, that's what I like, news coverage that reinforces my biases. We are all guilty of this. We self-select our news sources to fit what we already think. It's a terrible problem. For the country. So quickly, I'm going to go through some demographics that are changing to give you a sense of why, at the end of the day, I think it is unlikely that Donald Trump, maybe that gives some people in the room hope.
I don't know.
I'm not sure. At the end of the day, I think it's unlikely that Trump will actually be elected because of the changing demographics, but these present a huge challenge for Republicans going forward because many of these voters are not joining the Republican Party. The white vote is getting smaller. The female vote is increasing. It could be as high as 54% of the electorate this cycle. Ethnic minority vote has moved from 1 in 6 to 1 in 4 between 1996 and 2012. The Hispanic vote is increasing, and it's got a significantly higher potential. So this shows Obama carrying 71% of the Hispanic vote, Romney at 27%. But look at the eligible Hispanics this cycle. 27.3 million Hispanics are eligible to vote. The thing that Steve and I did, and this is actually some research from that presentation several years ago, is look at no major parties and their increasing vote in presidential elections. What's interesting is when you call people this cycle and say, do you self-identify as a Republican or a Democrat or an independent? Look at the difference. 42% of voters this cycle say, I identify as an independent, not as a Republican, not as a Democrat. So quick general election overview, and then we can get to Wendy and her questions. I just wanted you to see this. These are states that voted consistently in the past six presidential elections. Democrats won 18 plus D.C., so they start with 90% of the 270 electoral votes needed to win. Republicans consistently carried 13, starting with 38% of the 270. The challenge for Republicans this cycle and moving forward is that the average state that voted D in the past six elections delivers almost twice the number of electoral votes, 13 electoral votes versus 8 electoral votes. So there is an uphill battle for Republicans in the cycle, but there is a huge battle for Republicans and Democrats in that people are so incredibly dissatisfied with the process, dissatisfied with Washington, D.C. And, you know, what does that mean? I think it means that we're going to have to solve problems through the village square. We're going to have to do it at the local level. And I hope we get a chance to talk about that and how we do it. Thanks.
Thanks, guys. That was fascinating. One thing you did not touch on is the incredible amount of dissatisfaction with both of the major party candidates. In a recent CBS poll, 67% of the respondents found Hillary Clinton to be dishonest. 67%. 56% thought the same of Donald Trump. PolitiFact has evaluated 203 of Trump's statements and 226 of Clinton's. It rated 26.5% of Clinton's as mostly false or worse, and 70.5% of Trump's the same way. How do you explain that?
What's the truth? I mean,
but what my question is, why is he so much more likely to be seen as less dishonest than she is?
Can I go first because I have a different
perspective.
I
think because she has been in the public domain longer. This is a woman who has served as First Lady. She's been Secretary of State. She was involved with Obamacare before there was Obamacare. And so this is somebody whose entire life, both publicly and privately, has played out in public. It is very difficult not to have an opinion of Hillary Clinton, pro or con. Trump came on the scene as sort of this star, the head of The Apprentice, this billionaire who people were intrigued by in an era of the Kardashians. Look at the social media slides and look at where people get their news. They're not reading the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. They're going to the Daily Mail. I too am guilty of starting the day with the Daily Mail, even though I do try to read multiple sources of news. So I think she is so known publicly in a way that he is not, and his positions on issues are just now being exposed.
I'm going to take it to the first half of your question, and I would argue that this scenario is entirely predictable and has been foreseen. In that presentation you and I talked about where we identify the rise of independent voters and people who self-described as independent, and the fact that since 2008 in the state of Florida, a majority of people who walked in to register chose no party. So what's happening here? We have a system where more and more voters are saying they look to the left and they go, no. They look to the right and they go, no. And they choose neither party. Most people are centrists, but the system that we have in America and in the state of Florida doesn't allow for centrism. What it allows for is people in closed partisan primaries from the far left and people from in closed partisan primaries from the far right to be exclusively elected. And in fact, let me give you one example. In the state of Florida, there are 120 House seats. 120 House seats. At its best, 10 of them,
will be decided in November. Right, Alan? Okay, 10 of them will be decided in November. That means 110, 5 out of 6 House races will be decided in the primary. What does that really mean? In almost every one of those seats, a majority of registered voters are legally prohibited, statutorily barred from voting in an election that determines who's going to represent them and who ends up representing them. Someone from the very far left, look what happened to Eric Cantor, okay? He was defeated, the House Majority Leader was defeated in a closed partisan primary in his district. Here, I analyze this race. He outspent his opponent almost 25-1. But here was the messages that threw his butt out of office. Message one, yes, I will go over to the White House and negotiate with the President of the United States.
Oh!
Two, I will never let the government shut down again. That was wrong. We shouldn't have shut that down. There are seniors who need their Social Security. There are people who need access to health care. Our military was getting stressed because of that. I won't let our government shut down again. Those, to me, to Steve VanCorp, seem like fairly reasonable things that a legislator would say, and he lost in a landslide. So where am I coming from? Everybody's unhappy. Not everybody. A majority of Americans are unhappy with both choices here. Well, is it any wonder? The process we have statutorily in place says, give me the person from this side, give me the person from this side, and the rest of us have to figure out how to work together in the middle.
And there are some efforts to try to change that process.
That's
with
right.
The high level of dissatisfaction with the process as it exists, with the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, what are the alternatives for primaries? What are the alternatives now for, we've seen a Libertarian Party that put out two reasonably credible candidates, former governors. One of them kind of messed up on the whole Aleppo question. You should know probably where Aleppo is if you're running for president. But what do you see as the alternatives? How do you see the landscape in 10 years? Are we going to change the primary system? Are we going to add another political party? Will the Republican Party become something different?
What do you think?
Actually, Charlie Ranson is here. He's working with an effort in Florida to offer independents more options and to move to an open primary. So I'd be interested in Charlie's thoughts on that. I think, it is difficult at the federal level to field a centrist candidate who's an independent. The process is still set up to support a Republican and a Democrat right now. And it is very difficult to be elected president if you don't win the nomination of a major party. And when you nominate somebody like Gary Johnson, where is Aleppo, or what is Aleppo, is sort of a catchphrase now, right?
Yeah.
We'll be using that for years for anything crazy somebody says. The other thing you don't want to do if you're running as a third-party candidate is just announce that you quit smoking pot the week before you entered the presidential race. There just seems to be something about that that is not reassuring. So I don't know if Charlie has thoughts or on what's happening in Florida.
How about this? Okay. Well, there are a couple of different ways to approach this. Jonathan Rauch had an article in the Atlantic Monthly, the July-August edition, where he talks about what's happened to the election process. And he points out that in the 2016 presidential primaries, Pew Research Center, less than 20% of Republicans voted in primaries, less than 15% of Democrats voted in primaries. That's within the parties themselves. In Florida, we're approaching 30% of the registered voters in the state of Florida are neither Republican nor Democrat, and they are barred from voting. Their taxpayers, I'm a no-party affiliate, our tax dollars are paying for an election that we can't vote in. There's something seriously wrong with that. But we're not going to change that legislatively, because the people who are the beneficiaries of that system are the ones who run the legislative process. There are a couple of ways to do it, and probably the constitutional referenda are the way to do it. You can either go to an open primary where everybody votes. You have a Republican, you have a Democrat, people can choose one or the other. Or one that probably makes the most sense is what's called top two. Rather than having a Republican primary and the Democrat primary, you have a single unified primary on primary election day where every candidate, Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Working Families Party, whatever, one list of candidates, and everybody stands in the top two, move forward to a general election campaign. You know, it's hard to change this system. Everybody is, we have this ingrained Republican and Democrat party system. Minor parties come and go, but they have not stuck. I've talked to some friends of mine who say they think if Donald Trump wins the election, there will be no Republican Party in 4 years. Others say if Donald Trump loses, there'll be no Republican Party in 4 years. And I've heard people say the same thing about the Democrat Party, just a little farther behind in the process. But the system, it's a broken system. It's dysfunctional. The question is, Congress is not going to fix it. The people have got to fix it, and they have to want to find solutions. So what you're saying is it all resonates very well. The Village Square is an ideal platform for moving ahead to get a political movement going where we really begin to solve the problems and we find people who are willing to work together to find solutions to problems. Yeah. Politics, when I was coming in, was always the art of the possible. Now, compromise is something that we just don't talk about anymore.
Mm-hmm. All right, great. Who out there has a question? Steve?
When you look at the 2000 election, it was very divisive, but at the end of the day, the American public came together and accepted those results. In fact, in 2001, after 9/11, 80% of the public found President Bush as a positive leader. One of the concerns I have after this election, where there's so much hatred, particularly from the Trump side, against Clinton, how do we come together when you have polls like Texas, it says 3/5 of Texans would secede from the Union if Hillary Clinton gets elected? How do we come back together as a nation after this divisive election?
This is going to sound sappy. I remember in 2008 coming home crying. I was crying with joy when Obama got elected. And then a few months later, woke up to the Tea Party. And at first, I was, for those two of you who watched The Usual Suspects, I was very supportive of what I saw originally coming from the Tea Party, because in its nascent movement, they were worried about the declining middle class. And then somewhere along the way, it morphed into something different. And I'm not, if anybody here supports the Tea Party, I'm not trying to be adverse in that regard, but I think we set the tone, Steve, at that time that we don't have to come back together. And we saw an America that chose to make outlandish claims the president wasn't born in the United States and start to make up stuff. And social media fed that, and Sally was exactly right. You know, that post-purchase marketing behavior, that selection bias, as we call it in the industry, has gotten far, far worse and far quicker. You get your speaking notes by the time you wake up in the morning on your Twitter feed as to what you should be saying and what's wrong. Other than groups like this coming together because they feel a genuine need to say, I disagree with some policy issues of Sally Bradshaw, but I love her as a fellow American. I love her approach. And I know that if you put Sally and I together in a room, that we would come up with solutions to the problems facing whatever. But guess what, folks? The way the system is built, Sally, you could never get elected to office. I know I could
that
never get
true.
Elected. If I had to run in a Democratic primary, I'm too much of a centrist. I couldn't survive. And, well, you don't belong to any party now. But
All I could vote on was the solar ballot initiative.
The system deselects pretty much everybody in this room. And, Steve, it's a really good question, and I don't have the answer to it. I'm usually an optimist. I'm a very optimistic person.
But I did a presentation the other day about the 16 laws that parties have over non-parties to give themselves advantages in elections. So everything from, they get cheaper postage. They get cheaper postage. How unfair is that to an independent candidate or to an issue group? They're allowed to funnel money. They're allowed to take money from you and give it to Sally, but give it to the party first and give it directly to you, like soft campaigns. Only they can earmark it. There's all kinds of disadvantages that the system is rigged against an independent movement. And one last thought, this does not mean a third party is emerging. Most nonpartisans, it's like that bowling alone. People aren't leaving bowling alley A to go to bowling alley B. They're just no longer bowling. And people no longer really want to be a part of either political party. And frankly, can you blame them?
I actually am going to get the mic and ask my own question, which is, Jonathan Rauch, our speaker from last April, wrote a piece, the cover piece in Atlantic a couple months ago, you know, how politics went insane. And one of his basic premises, you're talking about how you and Sally could reach some kind of accommodation to move forward. Well, I believe you could. I don't know if either one of you smoke, but in some ways, John's thesis was that we don't have enough, counterintuitively, we don't have enough smoke-filled rooms where people of goodwill try to hammer out some sort of compromise. I'm just curious what you guys think of that.
Well, this is a start. I mean, I think everyone in this room, regardless of the outcome, is going to be an American before a partisan, is going to be an American first. Whatever the outcome of this election, no matter how severely disappointed we are or how excited or how much malaise probably the majority of us will feel, because no candidate is perfect this cycle. Both candidates, I think, have huge issues. We got to go forward. We have to get things done. And whether that is done at the local level, where you're starting to see a real cross-partisan movement, where local governments work with the private sector and try to get things done, because bridges have to be built and schools have to be fixed. In a lot of states, we have to balance our budget. Our legislature, I don't know where Representative Williams went, but I mean, you have to find a way to compromise. You have to find a way to get things done. And so you may see a dysfunctional federal government for years, for the rest of our natural lives, but local government leaders and business and philanthropists get together to solve problems.
And there's another reason why I believe municipalities and counties work better, and to beat my same drum, is every municipal, I think all 411 municipals in Florida, I think except one, their elections are nonpartisan and they're not gerrymandered. So when you're elected mayor of the city of Tallahassee or DeLand or DeBary or Largo, wherever, you have to answer to the entire electorate. One of my favorite stories is a good friend of mine, she's now a congresswoman, Lois Frankel, was a member of the Florida House of Representatives. Does anybody remember Lois here? Okay, hard left winger, right? Okay, so she calls me up and she's now the mayor of West Palm. And my first meeting with her, she's gonna kill me, they're telling you the story. My first meeting, I come into her, she's running for re-election for mayor, and she sits down with me, and the very first thing out of left wing Lois Frankel's mouth was, "These damn unions." And what have they done? She goes, "Well, I have to write a $10 million check because they mismanaged my pension fund, and I've gotta by statute, I gotta pay them the money, right?" And then she says, "Okay, here's the deal. You're going to run my re-election for mayor." She was underwater. She was losing. She goes, "I got $400,000 in the bank. If you can't win with $400,000 for 11,000 votes, we both suck." This was her actual words. But I said, "Where'd you get all that money from? That's amazing." She said, "The business community. They freaking love me." So what happened? Did Lois change, or did the electorate change her? Because when she was in Tallahassee, she was from Palm Beach. She only had to worry about her left flank. She only had to worry about losing or winning in a Democratic closed Democratic primary. Now she comes back to the city of West Palm Beach. She's got to represent everybody in the district. She moved to the center. I would walk down the street where there was one of the most annoying things in the world, because everybody would stop and hug her. Okay, I don't know why she was pulling so badly, but they loved her. She was getting things done. She was going to move City Hall. She was going to consolidate government. She was cutting all these expenses. She was building new high-rises, and everybody loved her. Okay, that transformation, to me, is where it needs to come from, is when elected leaders need to not have to answer to that. They have to answer to all of you. I'm very Jeffersonian about this. When the entire body of people get to choose and decide. I think that's what makes a better government. And that's what we see in local governments. And local governments are really the leading edge of a lot of positive change in government and in our communities.
Agree.
Yeah. All right. Let's look at Florida for a minute. That's where you're polling.
Yes, ma'am.
And Sally, you've had a lot of experience. So the Census Bureau figures show that the number of Floridians, 18 to 34, now outnumber those over 65. Millennials are seen to be more diverse and more liberal on social issues than their older counterparts. What's going to happen? Are they going to vote or not?
You go.
So you've probably seen more recent polling data that's Florida-specific than I have. Nationally, you know, one of the challenges for the Clinton campaign right now is the millennials are disillusioned with her.
Yes.
And they are starting to look at Gary Johnson as a real alternative or towards staying home. I mean, my sense is millennials are more liberal socially, that they tend to be more conservative with their money and more libertarian with government being involved in regulating their business and, you know, being in their way when they have a great idea and they want to develop it, and the use of the internet and social media. And so they're sort of an enigma right now. And it's going to be, you saw the numbers on the 18 to 29 year olds in that chart in terms of where they get their news and how they process news and information. And, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see the impact in Florida, which has been such an older state. People are living longer, but, you know, millennials are not happy.
And the millennial phenomenon, I see a rabbi and a priest in the room, right? That sounds like a bad beginning of a bad joke. You're probably fighting, Jack, with your congregation of fewer and fewer millennials joining, and they're not joining. Well, they don't join political parties either, and they don't really identify with either party. The fact is, will they vote? Probably not, and it's not a millennial problem. It's people under 30 rarely vote anyway.
Well, they voted for Obama, though. I mean,
the raw numbers were still relatively low to other ages.
They voted at a higher level for Obama than they will this cycle,
right.
I think.
You know, that's true.
So it's going to be interesting to see, why are they not as enthused for the first female president? Why are they? What's your theory on that?
Backlash after Bernie. They loved Bernie so much that they never, despite Bernie's best efforts and other people's best efforts, we're not seeing them liking, you know, getting excited about Hillary.
Yeah.
So it's really that simple. You know, some social scientists way smarter than me say, you know, people don't really start voting. Their horizon is low until they start, you know, buying property, getting married, having children. Well, guess what they're doing? Millennials are doing all those things later and later in life. So we're pushing that bar out. I think I'm the only person over 50 who's optimistic about what I see coming from millennials. I know they care. They do engage. They just engage differently. They are studious, but they're studious differently than we were. Yeah, they don't take the Wall Street Journal, but they do read news sources, but they read them on different tablets. Funny thing, I had done a series of focus groups for the Florida League of Cities on millennials, and I remember asking a question. We got to the section on social media, and just as a softball question, there's about 22 millennials in a room, and I said, how many of you use Facebook?
None of them.
Right? Two raised their hand. And I'm like, really? Only two of you use Facebook, huh? Wow. And I said, well, tell me about that. And she said, well, I have grandkids and my mom uses it, so I got to put the kids, my children on Facebook. But you know what it turned out? By the way, how many in this room, how many of you use Facebook? Raise your hand. Okay. I asked the wrong question. I should have asked how many of you are registered on Facebook and have checked your Facebook status or a message from Facebook more than 10 times today. Do you know how many would have raised their hands? Every single one of them. Talking to millennials about social media is like talking to the fish about the water. Okay? They don't get it. They're so submerged in it. It's such an integral part of their body and their being. They don't text. I use Kix. I use this. I use that. I use all these other systems that I teach this and I didn't even know what was going on. So they're engaged. They're just engaged differently.
Yeah, and they solve problems using, you know, social media. Some people in this room know this story, but when our daughter she's 15 now, when she was 12, she came to me and said, can I have an Instagram account? And I said, no, you cannot. And so she said, can my pet hedgehog have an Instagram account? And I said, distracted by a million other things, oh yeah, that's fine. She has 99,000 followers of a pet hedgehog right now. And I would be in big trouble if I did not tell you to leave here and follow Adventures of Calico on your Instagram account. Yeah, but she has found a workaround for her mother's admonition not to use Instagram. I mean, it's pretty
remarkable.
I'm going
to question your parenting about having a hedgehog for the first owner of a pig, so forget
it. As opposed to a pig?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Here, Robin.
Yeah, just a question. When you ask what's going on with the race, I think about gender. No surprise, right?
Right.
But I really think that there are issues around...
I really think with the media, that the media is sexist a lot of the times. I mean, I think if you look at what happened with the recent 9/11 thing when Hillary stumbled on the sidewalk, you didn't hear the hue and cry when General Petraeus fainted during congressional, you know, testimony. And just the way it seems to me that we're looking at the issue of gender or not looking at it in this election is really, really compelling. So anyway, that's my bias. Could you talk about
that? Robin, that brings up a really interesting thing. I remember when I was first delving into data, and I remember in Clinton, and the gap between genders was like 8 and 9 points, working white men at this level, working black men at this level, that kind of thing. The numbered gaps between, you're hearing numbers like 50, 60%. You talk about the big sort. Psychologically, in this presidential election, we're seeing numbers that I'm wondering, if somebody asked about a realignment, are we looking at a genuine realignment? Now, on the upside of the gender gap, we are talking about the man's hair more than we're talking about the woman's hair.
Yeah, and I would take issue just a little bit with that. We looked at a lot of data in our campaign about whether or not women would vote for Hillary Clinton. This was a really fascinating set of data that was done. And there are a lot of women who will not support, you know, women in positions of leadership or authority. I don't know why that is. I find it fascinating. But I think the reason Hillary's fall was covered so extensively is because she'd not been honest about her health. I mean, this is someone who is running for president, 48 hours earlier, was diagnosed with pneumonia. The right political move, and I know, Steve, you know, we make a lot of mistakes, but what we would not have done was wait 48 hours to confirm she was sick. We would have said, she's been diagnosed with pneumonia, she's going to take a couple days off the trail. And the problem was that it fed this perception that she was not being honest and trustworthy and not telling the truth. And that has been an issue with Hillary Clinton on many, many, many things. And so one thing you cannot do is make a mistake that feeds a negative perception, whether you are a male or a female. That is something that will follow you, and the press on both sides of the aisle will not let you live that down. And I say this as someone who is not a Donald Trump supporter by no stretch of the imagination, but I think the mistake she made is she fed a perception that she was not being truthful, and it took an issue that should have been nothing and blew it way out of proportion.
Well, you roll under Donald had been playing into this alt-right theory that she's really, really sick and she might be actually dying and blah, 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 blah. And then you had 2 days of news of delayed this and then she fall and then everybody
Why
kind of,
did she wait 8 hours to say she... I mean, it wasn't handled well and it could have been a nothing and it became much bigger than it needed to be.
But wasn't she afraid to admit that she was sick because of all of the rumors that were being put out there by
That's
Rudy
the theory,
Giuliani
but I think a lot
others.
Of campaigns would say the best way to deal with something is to put it out as soon as it happens. I mean, that's sort of rule 1, 2, and 3. If there is bad news, if there is something that has the potential to be a distraction, then put it out. In this day and age, with social and digital media, people are going to know, and you would rather control the timing of when they know than what the campaign ultimately had to do, which was withstand 8 or 9 or 10 hours of tough media.
So I'm going to go back to both of your points. Thank you, by the way. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having
for
us.
Just an intellectually stimulating conversation. I want to go back to the point you both made earlier about, is this the trend in politics and is this what campaigning looks like going forward? So in addition to the political problem with that and what our parties look like going forward, I have sort of a personal concern. As you both know, I'm Arab American Muslim, I'm a mom and a wife and all of that good stuff and a professional. And as I think about campaigning going forward and what our candidates are allowed to say, Democrat or Republican, it scares me that this is what the political framework might be like going forward, and I don't know how we get it back. And so if you could just comment on the rhetoric, regardless of whether it's on the Mexican issue, the female issue, the Muslim issue, it doesn't really matter. It's the negativity, and what does that look like going forward in future campaigns?
Go ahead.
I remember, you know, when my firm does any attack mail, negative mail, we have a very clear standard. Nothing leaves our approval if it's not truthful, verifiable, and relevant. And what I'm afraid of right now, and I remember when you'd campaign, you would never say, I'm going to pick on you, Steve. Steve Ufelder is a liar. You might say, well, what Steve said isn't exactly the truth, or Steve's skirting around the truth on this one. But we've now entered a new era where you can call people really bad names. I mean, can we stop for a second? We just had a presidential election where one candidate made fun of another candidate's penis size. Call it however euphemistically it was done. That's what really happened in American politics. I don't know how you unring that bell. And the fact that you can get away with this over and over again, and I don't want to hear me say, well, that's what caused Marco to fail. No, he was already failing, and that was a desperate endeavor. I don't know how we unring the rhetoric. And let me give you one example. It just happened yesterday with a candidate of mine. We got our polling back, and we saw, despite the fact that previously Donald Trump had been behind two, he's now up 13 in this particular blue-collar district. And my candidate went into an interview with the local newspaper, and when I saw it, I hardly recognized him. He was being belligerent and rude and obnoxious. Sound familiar? And I said, what the hell was that? You were belligerent? He goes, listen, Donald Trump is surging in my district, and this is what people want. No more comment. It's trickling down pretty fast. And the American public loves it because they think it's reality TV.
So the biggest mistake I've ever made in an election was to vote for term limits in the state of Florida. And I'll tell you why I feel that way. I think in Florida and in other states where term limits exist, this may be happening. As soon as you are elected to the Florida legislature, if you're elected to the House, you think about running for the Senate. As soon as you're elected to the Senate, you think about running statewide or, you know, finding some higher office that you can seek. And it means your brain is in political mode from the minute you take the oath of office to the minute you file your paperwork for the next campaign. And not only have we lost, you know, institutional knowledge, I guess some of that is valid. I tend to be less inspired by that argument against term limits because I did think that new energy would come in and sort of break some of the gridlock. But now we are totally driven by politics, and we're totally driven by the need to act like a Donald Trump supporter or to say this to motivate Hillary Clinton supporters. People, good people, have to stand up and say no. And it is done one step at a time, one person at a time, taking the risk, doing the right thing. And everybody who comes to a Village Square event, there are probably 100 to 150 people here, has the ability to go out and do that. You can still be a Donald Trump supporter. You can still be a Hillary Clinton supporter. But when the election is over, you have to be able to stand up and say, no, we're not going to behave this way. We're going to work together. We're going to find someone who doesn't look like us, who we don't regularly talk with, mm-hmm. and we're going to take them for a cup of coffee or perhaps, you know, a glass of bourbon is more appropriate in this cycle right now. And we're going to find a way we can work together on a project. We're going to learn about their family and their friends and the way they worship or don't worship, and we're going to lift them up. I mean, that's how you have to do it. It's the only answer I know of. People have to stand up. So,
Wendy, I have a couple questions. Do you mind if I jump in? Or,
I don't even see where it's coming from.
So I'm one of those registered independents who would say I'm both a member of the Never Trump and the Never Hillary movements. And given that this is, and so I would, but I don't want to throw my vote away this year. So given that I would be considered, I guess, a swing voter, the traditional conventional way in which you try to win over swing voters is by either arguing that your candidate is more competent or that the other candidate is even more unacceptable. But it seems to me that for me at least, the most persuasive argument that either candidate could make would be, or either party would make, would be to say, if you vote for us this year, you may get stuck with our candidate, but you may not get stuck with them for 4 years. And the reason I say this is Republicans could basically argue, if you vote for Trump, he is arguably more likely to resign, given his business interests, or more likely to be impeached, given the fact that many Republicans like Sally don't particularly like him. Similarly, on the Democratic side, the Democrats could argue, hey, if you vote for us this year, Hillary may need Tim Kaine to step in before 4 years are up, given her health problems. Now, I may be the only person in America who would be persuaded by these arguments, but I'd be curious to know whether, in view of the fact that none of the other rules apply anymore, whether the parties ought to be considering these unconventional messages to reach swing voters like me.
I don't know how to answer that, Bill. I don't know that needs a response. You said it so well. Oh, it's tough to know what would move a swing voter in one direction or another.
I'll tell you something funny. To Charlie's point earlier about the all voters vote initiative to let everybody participate, I met with my friend Allison Tan, who I think the world of, and Scott Arsenault, who's doing a great job with limited resources of the Democratic Party. And we said, listen, this would be an opportunity to moderate votes, to get more people into the process. And Allison, of course, you all know Allison, she's like, I love this. And Scott says, no, we would lose power. The Democratic Party of Florida spokesperson said, we would lose power. Paul got the joke right away. We have more Democrats in Florida than Republicans, yet the entire cabinet, the governor's mansion, both legislative bodies have veto-proof majorities in both chambers. I'm like, well, what power? Did I miss the memo? So,
but the parties themselves have less power now.
The parties have measurably less power.
Because of self-funded candidates and because of super PACs, the parties have been stripped of any ability to really drive the process, other than, to your point, that it is very hard, you know, to have anything to vote for if you don't vote as a Republican or you don't vote as a Democrat. But in terms of what the parties themselves, the structures, the power they wield, it's almost...
They become a bank account, and an unnecessary bank account, because here's what candidates can do. I can run for office, God forbid, Steve Van Cor, and I could create a separate fund called Friends of Steve Van Cor. One fund you're limited to $1,000 to, one fund you can give unlimited money to, and I control both of those. What the hell's the difference? And why would you bother about a party? And also, when you look at party, how many elections are decided in the general? They really exist for the statewide elections now only, not really down ballot. And because the rules have been so morphed and altered that we can control soft and hard, the candidates can control them and coordinate those dollars. There's the restrictions on soft dollars, or dark money as it's called, are so silly. The only things you can't do in a soft campaign is say, vote for Lori or vote against. But I could say, Lori is a hell of a good guy, and he is. Or I could say, Jeannie is not a good person. She actually is a very wonderful person. But you'll get the joke, right? If I say this person's bad and this person's good, I don't have to say vote against or vote for. When I referenced that Richard Mitchell-Charlie Williams race in 1998, we didn't do a single piece of hard mail. All of that was through soft funds. So the party's role in the process has become dramatically diminished anyway. So very good point.
Hi, I just want to echo what you're saying. I'm a professional lobbyist and very proud of it. I represent the prevention of child death, abuse, and neglect, also health and human services, trauma hospitals, etc. So this past session, I went around doing candidate interviews all across the state. In some markets, some districts, I had two words, clown school. Other districts, it was clown school dropout. And then other districts, it was like, oh my gosh, you folks are amazing. Why are all the candidates in one area? But the one thing that I echoed across was, you didn't know who was Republican, who was Democrat. I don't think Ronnie Reagan would get a nod today. You know, you have people who are coming in, like you said, that are millionaires, they're self-funded. We're supposed to have a citizen legislature, and the majority are attorneys or millionaires or et cetera. So here's the problem with the term limits, and my question is going to be, how do we get out of this? Because in child welfare, you've got people who come in for 2 years, 4 years max. They're making decisions on bills that don't go into effect for 2 years. They're not going to be here. You talk about the loss of historical knowledge. I flipped that. The historical knowledge, I had a staff member tell a chairman, a legislator, who was the elected official, that he could not put a bill in his committee. He could not put that up. This is not an elected official. This is a staff member. And the amount of power surge and how that's moving. How do we, you're a perfect example. This is a purple state of mind here. How do we have a statewide where we can, if we try through the legislature to create term limit changes, people only are going to hear they want to stay in longer and be career. How do we have this type of relationship only do something to help us actually move this needle, because it's not going to get any better?
You mean with respect to term limits?
Right.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you'd have to do the reverse of what was done to put term limits, you know, in place before. You'd have to have a ballot initiative. You're not going to get the legislature to, I mean, I guess you could convince the legislature.
The Constitutional Revision Commission is coming up.
The Constitutional Revision Commission.
What are the odds of them doing it?
But you'd have to probably, you have to do it on the ballot. You have to get enough citizens to say this isn't working. And that's going to be a hard sell. I mean, you know, there are a lot of arguments on the other side. It's going to be tough to do. So I'm not an optimist on this one, unfortunately.
No, Arkansas has ridiculous term limits. They have lifetime term limits, 6 years, and the legislature meets only every other year. So you, as a the House members meet 3 times. They also, as a state of 3.5 million people, I think they have 160 House seats. So it's gotten to a point where, like, Steve, you run. No, Sally, you run. I don't want to run. You run. And lifetime term limits. So the business community came together and said, this is ridiculous. So they came up with an initiative called Term Limits That Work. And they did 12 years in the House and 14 years in the Senate, and there were no longer lifetime bans. It failed 2-1. Voters like, it's their way to punish electeds. And we on the inside see that I could support a longer term limit.
Because
I remember the good old days of W.D. Childers and Dempsey Barron. But we did beat Dempsey, right? But you had people who were in there and entrenched forever. Nothing against Freddie Littman, but he was there for a very long time. I think he did a good job. But after a while, you're like, you know, there does need to be some new blood. But here's the other problem. To change the Constitution, like we're talking in Florida, $3 million entry level. If you want to change the Constitution of Florida, write a $3 million check. It's a direct result of nuclear war happening between the trial bar and the business and the medical community. After a while, they said, oh, screw this. We can't afford this anymore. Because when you get to the ballot, you have a big ballot fight. My first statewide campaign was in 1988. It was a shocking $15 million statewide campaign. But then it went 1994, 2001, 2004. Finally, they said, screw this. And they made it really, really hard to amend Florida's Constitution. And they closed the door for everybody else. If we wanted to undo term limits, if we wanted to have some form of open primaries, the entry-level ticket, just ask John Morgan. It's $3 million to get on the ballot. There's no other way around it.
Well, that would be a much better thing for wealthy funders to fund than presidential candidates.
That's
right,
exactly
either,
right.
Party, so.
Sally, you talked a lot about the demographic changes, mm-hmm. and with the demographic changes, with the browning of America, for instance, what is the political landscape going to look like across political parties in, say, 10 years?
So we'll, you know, have a majority-minority situation pretty quickly, and that's one reason that I really thought in 2012 the best way for a Republican to get elected was to have an understanding of these changing demographics. You know, I am a conservative. I may not be a registered Republican anymore. I may be an NPA. I may be a person without a political party country. But I'm a conservative, and I believe conservatives still have the best answer for people who are in poverty. I mean, we lift people out of poverty, lift them up, give them opportunity, give them, you know, better educational opportunities, better opportunities for jobs. I mean, go down the list. We blew it this cycle. For whatever reason, instead of having, we had minority candidates who were running for president. Our own senator from the state of Florida could have been the nominee. but was rejected. And I think what Republicans have to do is start to look more like America. They have to do what Democrats just naturally have been able to do because of their base of support. But they have to offer a different, more hopeful, optimistic vision for the country that lifts people out of poverty. And until the Republican Party recognizes that and begins to field candidates that look like America, in my lifetime, I don't believe the Republican Party will elect another president.
That's a big statement.
Well, the qualifier was until they recognize, right. You know, this demographic shift.
Yeah, exactly right. One of my dumber theories, I call it the baby bird theory, is when, you know, the baby bird pops its head out of the shell, the first thing it sees, it fixes onto. Think of Cuban Americans who came here and rebuilt, you know, South Florida to some degree. Who did they see waiting at the shore greeting them with open arms in some, you know, in the 80s was Ronald Reagan. Said, come on in, lift yourself up, we're going to do good things, we're going to work together, and you have a generation of Cubans who otherwise, frankly, would have been Democrats, love the Republican Party. I remember campaigning in Republican primaries with two Cuban candidates who were both pro-choice, you know, pro-this, pro-that. They looked like Democrats, but they were hardcore Republicans. And now, if the Republican Party elects this Donald Trump, I think you will lose a generation of Hispanics who will never identify with the Republican Party, even though maybe their philosophical leanings might be pro-life or whatever. They're going to identify with the Trump saying, you're all a bunch of rapists and thieves, et cetera, et cetera. So I agree with Sally that if the Republican Party's masthead doesn't become more friendly, what's interesting about this is I'm polling all over the state, and where you see the state is about even between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton right now. It's not even in a normal sense. Hispanics are very strongly anti-Trump, but there's a balancing act here. It's our neighbors about 15 miles to the east and about 17 miles to the west of Tallahassee. Dixiecrats and other Democrats, working class, white middle class families, are flocking to Donald Trump in the same opposite numbers that Hispanic voters are flocking away
from. And what's interesting is Hispanic registration in the state. And look at Cubans specifically, which have always, to Steve's point, been a base of support for Republican. They are younger Cubans are overwhelmingly registering no party or no Democrat. Point. They are not registering Republican right now. So it's a challenge.
Cuban, mm-hmm. and increasingly they're not. And so Puerto Ricans,
in Central
Democratic
Florida,
right. NAFTA.
Right. I think there were some questions.
I have a couple questions over here, Wendy.
Okay.
I thought we were going to get questions on polling. And
Hi, this is a little bit of a non-segue because I had my question quite a while ago. We've talked a lot about lying in this campaign.
About what?
Lying.
Okay.
Who's the bigger liar? First, I would say that not telling something about yourself isn't equatable to lying. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, we've got that situation, but we've got people just throwing lying bombs out there, like the birther thing. I mean, when Donald Trump then disowned it and pinned it on Hillary, I mean, I'm thinking about how can I have a civil discourse with someone on the other side of the aisle or the table or the issue. And we're not even looking at truth in the same way. It's totally a post-truth society, and I don't know how we get to civil discourse in this environment.
Well, and one of the challenges is that, and far be it for me to be a defender of Donald Trump, I think my position on Trump is pretty clear, but I think Trump voters, Republicans that have stayed with Trump, would argue on the other side of this that Clinton was not honest about her emails and about the confidentiality of the emails and how those were handled. I mean, the problem is, to your point, on both sides of the partisan divide, we are such a polarized electorate that any national presidential election ends up where it is right now, which is dead even, and independents and no-party voters will be the deciding factors in this contest, just like they've been for the last several cycles. I mean, what you have to do is come together with reasonable people in an organization like the Village Square who are willing to say, you know what, I bet you are, based on what you've just said, I bet our political views or our views on policy are very opposite, but my guess is that we have more in common than either of us think. So I think if we sat down and had a conversation, we would talk about children or grandchildren or travel or our hopes for the future or where our kids went to school or what we think the problems are in public education and how the city's going to deal with the next hurricane and should we have underground power and all of these issues that we have in common. And I really would urge, and I know Liz does this every day, every one of you to make a commitment tonight that regardless of the outcome of this election, you are going to do exactly what Liz Joyner preaches, which is you are going to find someone who doesn't think like you, who doesn't look like you, who doesn't share your political values, and you're going to form a friendship with them. And you're going to find a problem to solve no matter how small. It might be something you take before the school board or you take before the local high school, you know, planning committee or your place of worship. If you do that in a small and incremental way, it builds. And it will make a huge difference for this community, which is really about all we can control right now. I mean, I've sort of given up being able to, once I registered No Party, it was clear I did not have a future in the political world. So I'm starting an independent bookstore because I believe that is a place
Actually, could you just say a word about Midtown Reader,
I just want to
the promotional segment of our program tonight?
What's that?
I wanted Sally to just say a word about Midtown Reader. Invite people to join her when she opens.
Thank you, right. Liz, for that. Right. So we are opening an independent bookstore here in Tallahassee. It's my belief that this, in a small way, is something we can do to bridge the divide. I mean, I believe we're probably all readers. We might like different types of reading, but readers tend to be people who are problem solvers. And this is going to provide a venue for people to come together, find books. We'll have lectures. We'll have authors. I might ask Steve to come in and do something after the election, another How Do We Survive the Election program. We'll partner with the Village Square, hopefully, on some things. And we'll open November 12th. We're going to be at 1123 Thomasville Road, the Midtown Reader. And you can follow us on all social media platforms and at midtownreader.com. Thank you, Liz.
Badly needed. I wanted to add one thing to what you said, but this process that we have, and we'll talk about it, and nothing will get done about it. I understand why the Founding Fathers created, you know, their system of electing because they were giving a nod to states' rights and all that stuff. But isn't it time to do away with the Electoral College so that people in Texas have a voice, people in California have a voice, people in New York have a voice? Because frankly, you were right, except only in about six states.
Yeah, that's right.
Only, really, when it comes down to it, in about six, maybe seven states, which always, listen, when you watch Florida, if Florida goes for Hillary, it's over. There's almost no way Donald Trump can win unless some bizarreness in this cycle, go figure. But it's only about six or seven states that really matter, which is sad, because I think every American's vote should count in this process. Maida?
Now,
just yell.
Yeah. All right. In the onslaught of media and today, coming in all directions 24/7, I have found that it's very hard to find the truth. I can't seem to find the truth. It is bogged down in biases everywhere. I on Facebook, I try to have civil conversations, and people jump on, and it's, I have to, like, blank them out. I have to block them because it becomes so argumentative that there's reason goes out the door. I try to figure it out. Why do you think this way? Give me your facts. Give me your thoughts. Give me your ideas. And a lot of people cannot. They just don't know why, but they can only say blasphemy, name-calling, and it has become so uncivil. And I'm trying to ferret the truth and the civility, and it's become so problematic. I'm just wondering, does anyone have suggestions who's telling the truth?
I'm out of answers on that one.
I got nothing.
I don't know.
Yep. We have a interrupt for a brief commercial.
Well, actually, no, I wanted to follow up on that question really quickly. So what is the role of facts? There's a lot of literature that talks about how we emote. Elections are about feelings. Americans feel things. Is there any place anymore for facts? F-A-C-T-S.
I certainly
facts.
Hope so. I mean, I would certainly hope so. Maybe the result of this cycle, it is possible that instead of us just sort of hitting a wall where everybody has to go to the local level and turn inward and that's the only way we're going to problem solve, it may be that we're at another tipping point where we've gone so far away from facts, so far away from civil discourse, that there could be a revival of sorts of truth-telling and facts and information. And I think, you know, that requires people to step up and demand it. I mean, if we're not asking for it, if we're not living it ourselves, if we're not demanding it, then it definitely won't happen. But there
truthful,
may be an
verifiable,
opportunity.
Relevant, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I guess, Steve, and I would love for you to talk very briefly about your column, because it was so humbling for me to read that and get a better understanding of things. But this is both a pessimistic statement and a very optimistic statement. If you look at the first contested presidential election in our nation's history, it was as ugly as this is today. Jefferson is going to turn your daughters, their words, not mine, into whores. Adams is going to send us back to Europe and make us be part of the king. You know, these horrible lies. They were hiring people to write broadsides that were just full of lies. And why is that both a pessimistic statement and an optimistic statement? That's somewhat typical in American politics in a rough and tumble of creating our democracy and our republic. But we survived, and we do pretty good, and we created at some level, some would argue, I would be part of that, one of the greatest nations this world has ever seen. So you can emerge from that and find some goodness. And your document you wrote about the difference between being a centrist and a moderate really speaks to that, you know, centrist is a political philosophy, moderation is an approach to accepting differences of opinions. Do you want to take? Can he take a minute to talk about that, Liz? Because it was so cool.
No, we'll do that later. but thank you very much for that. Before Wendy closes, and thank you, Steve. But before Wendy closes down, let me just say, everyone, please again go to your computer, go to your iPhone, whatever it is, and finish the survey. It would really make a big difference. With that, Wendy, let me turn it back to you.
So there's a new email that has a new link for you.
There you go.
And then shop at Midtown Reader.
Right.
Right. And just one last question. What are your predictions? Sally, how do you think this presidential race is going to end?
Who do I think is going to win?
Yep.
I think Clinton will win it, but, you know, she's not going to win by 400. She's not going to have 400 electoral votes. It is going to be a closer race, but I think at the end of the day, she'll win it. For the reasons we talked about earlier, which is Democrats start with a bank of electoral votes that are very hard to overcome. And I think at the end of the day, there are six states that really matter. And although those states are close, I think it is difficult. Trump would have to win Florida, plus pick up a North Carolina and a third state, which is not yet, you know, on the radar screen.
Yeah, so. The electoral. Well, as a pollster, this is a really tough question, because especially if I'm working on a campaign, you have to, you know, that two sides of the brain theory.
Right.
You have to really separate your hopes and desires from the numbers you're seeing. I agree with Sally, but this... 2 weeks ago, this was going to be an electoral landslide. The fact that the landscape has changed so quickly, and that most, and there's a bunch of really cool aggregators, one site called 270 to Win has not just predictions, but other people's predictions and models, and you could build your own map. 270 to Win, it's a great website. Right now, Hillary has the slight advantage. But I'll tell you what, if she has another week like this week or the last 10 days, Donald Trump could be your next president.
And next Monday night, I think, is going to be fascinating to see what happens at the debate.
It's not next Monday night.
Oh, I thought
the debate is Monday night.
Yeah.
It's not Monday night that'll determine what'll happen. It's the next day and the next day. What happens at the water cooler?
Right.
Are there water coolers anymore in America? Yeah. Whatever happens at the water cooler will decide who won the debate. That's my theory.
Yeah.
Not because every time I freaking watch a debate, I go, oh, my gosh, my candidate won. Right. The next day I'm like, oh. So, but it's usually how it's reported, and then what happens at the water cooler is usually it. So it's usually by Wednesday we'll have a
all
sense
right.
of it.
All right, Wednesday we'll know. Join That's me, funny. Please, and thank you, Sally.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
It's fun.